So I want to start off with, because Francois gave such a nice talk on, you know, kind of the ejecta you can get from neutron star, neutron star, neutron star, black hole mergers. And we had a couple comments on opacities and what do you actually see. And I wanted to just show kind of where, at least I'm at after working with atomic physicists for maybe too long, to figure out how do you get good atomic physics. And I just want to show you some of the problems we ran into. The black curve here is, this is cerium, is that what it is? Let me get an element that I actually know what these lanthanides, neodymium. Here's neodymium. I actually know what ND stands for. So one of the things I learned is I learned more lanthanide abbreviations than I ever thought I wanted to know. But there's two, he did two opacities, and the thing that you should bother you is, this is no Doppler, no broadening, artificial broadening of the lines, just what he would get if he did the lines and provided an opacity table to you. And I said, well, the lines are kind of broadened because there's a Doppler broadening in them. What happens if you broaden it? That's this red curve. Now, most of you should say, how did it go from here to here by doing the broadening? And what I learned from the atomic physicists is they do a grid of atomic physics. They calculate the lines. And when they want to calculate opacity, something centimeter squared per gram, if the line is really narrow and kind of small and it doesn't fit in their grid, they just ignore it. And so they don't do this in nuclear physics. In nuclear physics, they calculate, they make sure they get at least the right area. They may have the lines wrong in position and stuff, but they get the right area. Unfortunately, I think, so the point is, there's lots of little lines here that you don't see in the black curve that when he sums them up, doing what the nuclear physicists would do, you'd fill up this space and the opacity gets higher.
Well, did either of them actually do a curve of growth, or are they just assuming they're all off?
Oh, they do, yeah, they do the curve of growth, but that's pretty narrow for this cold, especially for neutron star mergers, it's pretty cold. So as far as that's concerned, that's pretty narrow. But the Doppler shifts are broader, yeah, but they don't include that unless you tell them. So this is them including that effect. So that's where it gets. So that makes a different opacity. Now, the reason you would think you don't do this is there's this expansion opacity that we use in supernova theory, where that, especially it's based, you take advantage of the Sobolev approximation, which, and then there's some additional assumptions to make it so you can use it for more than just one line. And, you know, if you want to learn about that, you go look at Pinto and Eastman, and they have a long discussion of it. But there, it really is, they're assuming that the big lines are what dominate. It's the number of these big lines. The photon gets in the line, but the Doppler shift is actually reducing the opacity, because you hit this big line and you're stuck in it, and the assumption is for the expansion opacity is that you get absorbed and then you're re-emitted at the same wavelength, so there's only one decay rate for that photon. So it's like you're scattering in that line, but because there's a Doppler shift, you eventually get out of it and you go to the next line. And so then you can calculate opacity using that expansion opacity. There's a couple of assumptions. One is that the opacity is dominated by a fairly sparse set of lines. You have to assume that the decay is always to the same energy, so you're not losing energy. Once you get absorbed, you just get re-emitted, so you can treat it like a scattering. The advantage of it is it's really easy to calculate. You don't have to do a lot of the work that you have to do here. You just need the line list. So you can do it much easier. And so Dan Kaysen, that's what he assumed. I'm just going through a paper because I'm not giving a talk. I'm just showing you some data. That's what he assumed when he calculated his opacities. And his opacities look something like this. We're doing the same expansion opacity approximation with this red curve as he did. And we get essentially the same answer, except some slight differences over here, I think, are the main differences we got from Dan Kaysen. But if I instead do this kind of broadening of the lines and calculate the opacity, this is the opacity I get. So the question is, which assumption is correct? And we at least, and the paper is submitted and it's not out on the preprint server, we at least have arguments of why you should, and we can argue about this, why expansion opacity isn't a valid assumption for these cases. And in Dan's paper, he's very clear. He says this may not be valid in this case, but that's what I'm going to assume. But if you get that difference, the issue is the opacity is like a factor of 10 different, and that's going to make a difference in your light curves. So that the only thing I want to impress on you on that is we're still not there. We're still trying to figure out how do we do these opacities. So this is harder than I thought when I went into it, and I you know, I don't know why people didn't warn me that it was going to be harder than I thought, but they. Yeah, it ends up making the events all redder, and I was going to show if I can. Did I actually? One other thing I wanted to show. However, this is where this, and this is not showing up that well. I'll have to see if I can increase. At 3 hours, this is where Francois stuff. We need to get these calculations right. These are light curves for something that has an ejecta. That the wind ejecta, whatever your wind ejecta, is made out of zirconium. And then there's a tidal ejecta that's made entirely out of, I think he used selenium for that material. So he only did two materials. This is done by Oleg Korobkin and Ryan Walliger. And they asked the question, what is the luminosity as a function of time? And let me give the caveat and why I'm a little worried that I'm showing this plot, is that when you just do two elements, so if I just say it's all selenium or something like that, any gap that's there from selenium alone is going to allow light to get out, or any gap in the zirconium. So what it ends up doing is making it much brighter because the radiation just comes out of the holes. If I had a mix of materials, and this is why getting the detailed yields is important, the different elements actually are filling in each other's holes. And so we found if you did a mix, everything goes redward as well. But so anything, this is an optimistic light curve. But at 3 hours, he actually gets a very bright in even the U band emission. The curves are at different viewing angles. So this is looking at where you're mostly seeing the disk. This is looking, if you're looking either on the top or bottom view. This 3 hours, 6 hours, still bright, 12 hours. It starts going redward at 1 day, quite a bit redward this is 2 days. And then by 4 days, it's gone toward the infrared, and this is for them at 6 days, and that's as far as they ran these calculations. But the point is, you can get, you know, depending on that abundance, at this point, you know, you're not seeing much, but depending on the exact abundance nature, you can get different answers. So until we actually do these abundances right, we can get different answers for what the light curves are. That may wash out a little bit if we start doing mixes of materials. So, because you don't just produce zirconium, you produce a whole band of materials. And I think that's going to turn everything redward. In fact, the simulations, if you do a mix, instead of just using selenium, if I do a mix, it's going to move it down this way. And so it's really bright. It starts to pick up above 1.6 microns if it's just this selenium. So that's what you're looking at. You want to go redward of 1.6 microns.
But I think the infinite opacity limit, let's say it's just black body, what is the black body of the light?
Because
it's basically
18K
of 4 days.
Yeah, I don't know what the temperature is. I have to. It's pretty cold, yeah. So
1 hour?
Oh, so 1 hour is still going to be in the... So 1 hour, I mean, the reason this is this high in the blue is at 1 hour, your temperature is pretty hot, yeah. So your black body is going to get you blueward. So a lot of this is cooling off. But this aspect is because the opacity, and that was in the previous slide. The opacities really are, you know, high. This is the opacity here is about here, you know, 0.04. EV, the opacity is getting toward 1, or maybe 0.05 EV. Your opacity is getting toward 1, which is quite a bit more than what you get on electron scattering. And by 0.1, you're looking at opacities of 10. So you really are, at this point, you're cutting out most of the emission above 0.1 EV, because it's all getting reprocessed down into the below that band. You're just seeing the photosphere. So what is it? It's whatever the photosphere temperature is.
I think that would depend on what the photosphere is.
That's right. So it's whatever you've decided your photosphere is. The way I was interpreting is infinite opacity limit is if I could assume it's a black body, what's its temperature, and go from there. But yeah, it is what you have for your initial temperature. And that's, especially these early times, I'm a little worried that whatever our initial conditions are, those can change. So I wouldn't put that much faith in things happening in the early hours. But it dominates the temperature. It's the whole thing dictating the temperature after a day, right? It's not your initial temperature. It's just what you're, you start getting the radioactive heating dominating. But it's so anyhow. I think getting these abundances right is important. But there's a couple things that we're suffering from. We're suffering from doing the atomic physics right, then implementing the atomic physics into our codes correctly, and then knowing what the initial conditions are. Which all of these are hard computations. There's lots of work to be done. The question, I think the easiest one to solve is the expansion opacity actually really, truly applicable for these problems? And we're in the process working with Phil Pinto to try and prove one way or the other on that. I'd be willing to bet, a reasonable amount of money that the expansion opacity approximation is not valid in these calculations, so we're going to have to do the harder work solution.
Can you say why you think that?
So first of all, it doesn't look like these lines can be treated like scatterers. It looks like when they decay, they're going to branch. There's fairly large branching ratios. If the branching ratio is anything, more than 1% going to something else, you're getting so many absorptions and re-emissions that it's going to end up getting changed into a different wavelength. So that the assumption is that it stays the same wavelength as it you can treat that interaction as a scattering. And, if you have 1,000 scatters, even if the branching ratio is fairly small. So the branching ratio for these lanthanides is not small like that, which at least Ron and Phil argued for iron in 1As was okay. I don't think it's true in the lanthanides. These lines are a lot denser than what you would get for the strong lines in 1A. So I think the density of lines is also much higher. These are things we can check. We can check what really is the at what density do we really worry that the density of lines is too much and you can't make the expansion opacity approximation? So, and we can do toy test problems to ferret this out, and that's what we're working on right now. Doing it with Monte Carlo. So, this can all be done. I think it's going to push in that direction of we have to do the opacities in the way that we're trying to do here, but it does mean that we have to think about this, and then it becomes but then the issue is if you can make this wind be not so neutron rich, that's going to be the saving grace of seeing things in the if not the optical, at least in the in some normal infrared near infrared bands. So this is the thing we haven't. The reason the plot that I showed you is kind of an insane way to look at it, but I'm working with the postdocs to do it in a more sane way. There are some. If you grab a random element that's somewhat neutron rich, it has some holes in the in the optical or infrared where it's leaking out material and leaking out photons, and you say, oh look, I get this high emission. But if they put in a full distribution of elements, I think those holes fill up. And so I can't say anything now until they start doing a mix of materials because I'm not sure how much of their results at the moment is due to holes versus due to where is the opacity. So we're trying to figure out where their holes are and how they implemented the opacities. But they aren't, I had a scheme, but they didn't implement that yet, which is why that particular result I was showing is in a very rough state. So, but it is true that depending on what I choose, I get a different answer. Yeah, and understand that atomic physics doesn't really get the positions of the lines that accurately anyway. So you're talking about something that they're doing their best attempt and they get an answer. But I think the nature of, if I have lots of different elements, their lines are not going to be lined up on each other, so they should spread out. And that's, so that is our hope, is that we can assume that they're spread out and get that result.
So Chris, what's the upshot on this then, say compared to Dan's light curves for a neutron star?
So we have opacities that are 10 times higher, so we're 10 times dimmer and we're a little bit redder.
Okay.
Is a kind of order of magnitude kind of way to see what's going on, and but the question is, I'm not saying that Dan is definitely wrong and we're right. I'm saying we have that there's the error bar right now. So Dan has one result. His most recent result is one where 10 times lower and a little bit redder. So it's going to be that much more work to try and see them. And that's all I wanted to say about that. I just wanted to. I got so excited because it looks like we're getting some. I'm going to then be pessimistic after I. So it turns out none of the organizers told me to be provocative, which implies that they didn't need that. I was not told to be provocative, and yet. I can unplug this. And yet. I can't help but be provocative at some level, which, okay, you guys knew that. I'm not sure. So I have this question, and I want people to answer it, but I'm not sure what we learn from the electromagnetic emission, and I'll tell you why. I was hoping, and this was based on for anything, we get a result. Say it's a neutron star merger. But let's start with the neutron star merger. And I was hoping that Francois was going to tell me that if the thing remained a neutron star, so it was a hypermassive neutron star with a disk, he got a lot more ejecta than if it collapsed to a black hole. Because then, or maybe the ejecta was, he could calculate already what the neutron fraction was if it's a neutron star. So, I would love to see if it's a post, what's the post-merger core? I'd love to be able to say, from the electromagnetic radiation, is it a neutron star or a black hole? And Francois can answer this, but the way I took your talk was, it's not clear we can tell. So what is LIGO? So how do we get? How do I say? Oh, I've seen this. I get electromagnetic radiation. How can I tell whether it's a neutron star or a black hole? What is the data that's going to tell me? So I have two neutron stars merge. So we have some chirp mass. And did it collapse to a black hole or not? Because if we could tell that, we could then say something about the equation state. But can we?
I mean, that's an SMR kind of statement, right? I mean, for a post-merger signature, if you get some kind of post-merger signature, like a massive neutron star, are you saying that, let's assume that LIGO says
it? Does it help us? So, if I have a really strong gravitational wave signal and I'm getting all then I can get something, right? In fact, if I saw some, it's this hot neutron star merger is going fast enough that I see some kind of instability, then yeah, okay, that's great in the gravitational wave signal. But okay, so I'm that's my first level of pessimism, is that I don't think we're going to get that many with such a strong neutron star. So let's say the signal is just good enough that you can get a chirp mass. So, I mean, the issue, so you can say whether, if it's a black hole neutron star, you can say whether, if you see an electromagnetic signal, you know that you had to have some lanthanides ejected. But it, let's say for a neutron star merger, all of those are going to get the tidal ejecta.
No, but then you're going to ask the question, do you have enough under the right characteristics to get to it? So if they are equal masses, then you can see that there's too little generated with the soft equation.
Oh, okay. So you use the equation. So, okay. So this is the thing is, you can, the equation of state tells you the mass of the ejecta. Is that so? Okay, and so, and so, and this can be observed in EM. Yes, it could say the difference between mass tidal versus mass disk accretion, but. Well, so you could do this, and certainly if I am in full agreement that if we got the observation, I could say we have this much with this neutron fraction and this much with the higher neutron fraction, and so I could tell this ratio. However, that doesn't tell me whether the post-merger core is a neutron star or a black hole, right? All it does is tell me what the ejecta. I have some idea of what the ejecta is, but
the properties of your disk ejecta are going to be very different if you have a black hole or if you have a neutron star, because the neutron star is going to radiate a lot more neutrinos.
So yeah, it is going to be different, but can we predict that at this point? So this is what I don't think we can predict.
The long-term evolution of the disk around the black hole is sort of at the limit between the two, and so no, we cannot say what it is at the moment.
So
there is still more work to do on that part.
Yeah, so
the neutron star one definitely raises YEI high enough, at least at 30 times.
But the exact how much you raise the YE really depends on your neutrino physics, and it's, I mean, if you go talk to George Fuller, there's lots of ways to change that neutrino spectrum. So it's you know, so the issue is, for this, it's going to be hard to really say, you know, okay, I have a neutron star or a black hole in the middle. So what it can tell us, we can use the EM thing to tell us, so, and you can correct me, I don't think that the neutrinos can somewhat affect the tidal ejecta YE. But not much. So it really is, you can say, what's the relative fractions of these, I think, from an EM observation. But where do we go from there?
You can get low YE from the disk, too.
Yeah, that's my problem. Is the disk one, this is my thing, is, so I was, Oleg Korobkin had convinced me that the disk ejecta, if you had a black hole in a disk, he didn't get that much ejecta. And if that were true, then I could do something. But if you were getting 5 to 20% from that disk, so you were showing 5 to 20% from the disk, and if it's that, then I confuse disk ejecta from stuff that's maybe the accretion process onto the neutron star. So. So you can, but doesn't it? So how strong of a, how close does the neutron star have to be to actually, the merger have to be?
Well, this is who's going to raise this question again. So there are some people we heard, you were not here on Monday.
Yeah.
We have maybe a statement of that. Because once you do that, you're trying to see what happens after merger. It's a trigger search. So some people, at least in the current origin, say you could bring down the SNR requirement a lot.
Okay.
No, I'm not asking. So he's only asking, wants to know if there is a black hole or a neutron star. That's, I don't want to.
There's no delay collapse, or you can detect the delay collapse.
No, I'm just talking about short time scale for a long time scale. So that it can be resolved. Exactly. But the point is, what people I talk to will say that you don't need to require an entire thing.
But this is a burst search, okay? This is essentially a burst search. And therefore, tens of megaparsecs.
I think we're answering different questions.
No, it's a trigger search.
Yeah, no, I understand. Right. But this is the burst at 2 kilohertz, 3 kilohertz, whatever it is. Okay? So it's just a few seconds. So I think it's 10 megaparsecs.
But they would say the burst all the way to 1.
I don't believe that.
No way. Because you can then you have a few cycles, the square root of n, square root of 3, you know, 1.7.
For the postmodern, it's not a free cycle, it's a long.
But
you can last 100
milliseconds. Yeah, 100 milliseconds.
I'm saying that we do know that if you form a black into a star, which is a massive little star, that it's not going to collapse to a black hole. It's ringing at a very precise frequency.
Can I
just the black hole is not going to ring.
Even
after
that, with the SNR24, we couldn't see it is ringing.
And so I think we've answered by immediately switching that to the gravitational wave discussion. We answered this question. Not very positively. That's my interpretation of that.
No, but let me focus on Chris's question for a second. Is that Chris's question not yet or not at all?
I think it's not yet.
Because like what I heard from Francois is that if you could do the neutrinos properly, then you know, accretion onto a hot neutron star is going to look different than the EM from a
star. Yeah, but I don't think doing a neutron properly, if you really want to be precise about it, is something that you're not going to do that soon, because it's an extremely expensive question. But I think even with the neutrinos we have now, if we could do long-term evolution of this with magnetic fields, which we are getting close to being able to do, we are already going to get much better answer for what the electron fraction that this digitizes. In the case of a black hole, in the case of a neutron star remnant, it's a lot harder to do the long-term evolution, but I think there we have a better handle already on what the YE is.
I think personally, the zero order thing for you see the optical counterpart is that it was a neutron star.
Yeah, sure.
Matter was ejected, and hopefully that it's at least order of magnitude consistent with being neutron. Yes. Okay, so and I was just gonna come back to the other position
So definitely
galaxies.
So the thing that we gain from electromagnetic measurements is position.
I think that's a very good thing.
Okay. Cause I mean we've known that for, you know, we knew that's what the main thing we were gonna gain. It's going to be very hard to see lines. There's not any dominant line. It's not like these, you know, you could Ion K alpha or something. You know, pick a bright line. You saw the opacities there. Once we started merging them together, there's some noise. But once you have this data. Oh, so you're gonna. So
the distinction between broadband photoelectric we'll get and whether we will actually get a spectrum that will show a line that's the same as our process lines we see in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
I think the answer to that is that's
going to be variable. So supernova, there's some, you know, really bright lines, and you look at the lines and you can get the line broadening to get you what the velocity is, you know, that you can get estimates of velocity. I don't think we're going to be able to do that. That you have the other point. You have the other point is the color evolution with time. You could perhaps tell something from that, but that then requires trusting people that do these light curves. And I think being one of those people, I don't trust us. So I think that's what we need to work really hard and try and do that. But that's also a hard problem. No. And I'm willing to bet it's going to be really dim. So, I mean, we're already struggling to get telescopes that are going to observe these at the peak. I think at the nebular phase, Yeah.
You have interesting spectral information. In principle, detectable, and then there's a question of the TNT, etc. Or JWST.
Yeah. I mean, there is a possibility there. I think the issue is that there's a lot more line. It's a much bigger forest of lines than anything. The lanthanides are a mess. I mean, yeah, if we can get some ejecta that's closer to the Iron Peak, I think it gets easier.
I think where you can make a difference, if you see, let's say, 1% of the stellar mass in optical, Iron Peak kind of material, I think that's extremely hard to do without a long lived neutron star. I think that would be a sign of a long lived neutron star. Because those low mass systems, when you have a black hole, it gets hard to get YE. You don't have a very compact disk, it gets hard to get a very high YE in the black hole accretion disk system if you have a 2.5 slow mass system or something like that.
And going back to your statement, so I think the answer is I would rephrase the question. What can we learn from EM measurements augmented with at least some partial information from gravitational waves? And that, then all of a sudden, I think you're on the different ball.
Well, but I was already assuming, the gravitational waves give me, I get a chirp mass, I can maybe get the component masses. That's good.
Let me tell you, for instance, already, depending on the mass ratio, that it has to be a black hole in the star system that was collided.
So I can tell whether it was initially, if I get really good measurements and the black hole is pretty big, not at that 2 solar mass range, I could tell that I could use it and say that it's a. I can say it is. It was a black hole neutron star versus a neutron star neutron star.
Right.
That I agree.
You can do something to go. You have a great point. In this event, you all could get so much, but that's a very very short lead after merger event signal. You actually generate a black neutron star that produces a long lead massive neutron star. Now you can accumulate this in R because it's radiating a very particular frequency.
So yeah, I mean you guys know this better, but what you can do at long term, as far as getting saying what the fate of the merged object is useful. But I think.
That's gravitational lines of light, right?
So yeah.
You get the post-merger signature, and he has a formula for basically what you expect the peaks to be as a function of the equation of state. And if you can integrate those up and try and get them, but it's hard to get with an A-LIGO-like detector because it's our subsystem that most of it's coming up. You need to push down something like A+.
But that paper also forgot to include the N=1, that is at half frequency.
Right.
So I'm not sure.
That big wave mostly very short lived peaks.
Yeah. Right.
Except for the phenomenon mode, it's very short lived. It's going to be that is really going to be 1.5 cycles at 2 kilohertz,
right?
1.5 kilohertz.
Well, if you have something that looks for a long time,
The phenomenon mode and the equivalent mode particularly are much longer lived, basically the lifetime of the neutron star of the disk.
So, what's the longest plausible post-merger remnant?
It depends on what you choose for your equation state. It has some maximum non-rotating mass, and so in fact this is one of the things I'd be interested in seeing is can we check with that, can we get a max some limit on that. If you have two if the maximum mass for your equation state is 2.5, I've been told by Sanjay Reddy if you push it above that they start to squirm. They don't know what they can make a parameterized model that makes a 3 solar mass neutron star, no doubt about it. But the physics models that they're currently thinking above about 2.5, it starts to cause them heartache, right? So can you determine? I have something where I know I have some estimate of the total mass. It's either from the gravitational something from the gravitational waves, total mass of maybe 2.5. And then if I can prove that it was a neutron star, I suddenly caused heartache to nuclear physicists, which is, of course, causing other people suffering is a big goal of mine. So, we're recording these.
2.5 is a little hard because if you want reasonably rapid collapse of the neutron star for 2.5 maximum mass, you need a system which is probably at least 3 solar mass. Total system is 2 SMRs. That's already pretty heavy neutron stars before. It's possible if you have like 1.6 or something like that, but it's probably not the most. It's getting difficult.
Yeah. So that was my comment here is, if you need such a high gravitational wave signal anyway, then I'm going to constrain the equation state via just the gravitational wave signal alone. So the EM doesn't provide anything, except for, again, the position. I'm happy with the position being.
Well, it also provides a whole heck of a lot of other things. Right? Because if you now tell me you know well that the electromagnetic counterpart came at whatever delay from the main gravitational waves, now you can begin to
what is the fundamental physics question I'm getting?
I'm going to throw something that's really out there, so do we live in a brain or not? So that, is there a velocity different in propagation of light speed versus propagation of gravitational wave speed? Something all sort of crazy people out there.
Yeah. So the I mean, certainly if it's pointed, I mean, if you see things and it happens to be pointed at you and you see a G or B, that's okay, you're all golden and you have that. But okay, so this is the other thing, and I actually like that, speed versus photon speed. I mean, we did this for, of course, 87A, we did the neutrino speed, right? We could get an estimate on the neutrino speed, which then the neutrino detectors proved wrong, and then proved right again. I have another question, but I'm not sure I should ask it because this one was. Okay, that's better. I'd rather.
So we have a merger rate from LIGO, and we have an ejected mass roughly from some light curve detection.
So I think
we know roughly how many R cross elements we need to produce per galaxy to explain. There's a timing issue. I totally agree there's a timing issue. It's either two versus half. It's the same thing with the neutron cell injury, just kind of self-relation rate roughly. So you can
So can you prove that it's a
without spectrum? I think this is a real challenge.
But okay, yeah. And and rate. So yeah, I'm not quite sure we can get the ejected mass. You can get a rate, and then you can, if you trust the theory rates, I mean theory ejected masses, that tells you whether our process can make it. I think it's going to be hard to say, oh, this I see some ejecta. Let's say if it is really red, you can say, and I would feel I would that would justify, I think it is, you're ejecting this lanthanide stuff. But since we're not, there's no line saying, ah, you saw europium or you saw uranium, you're not going to have something that there's no way to get around it. But I don't actually doubt that the tidal tail stuff has to be neutron rich in our process.
But just one question: the opacity caveat would apply to whatever contender is out there, right? For the origin part of it, would be
quite. No, I think the distinction here is whether you can measure directly from the infrared optical emission a mass, and usually there's a degeneracy between ejecta mass and opacity for the transfer stuff. Chris is saying that degeneracy is uncertain at the order of magnitude.
I guess there's also a question about opacity of multiple peaks, right? Can you distinguish layer opacity from platinum opacity?
So that actually was specifically the worry that I had is can we distinguish a pure iron? Can you really, it would be nice to be able to say something about just from the colors and or spectroscopic constraints.
I think you will get something. You can probably make a reason. I mean, even though we have uncertainties, I think if you see something that's bluer, it's going to. Then I'm going to be more convinced that it's first peak, iron peak to first peak kind of area, and versus it's all the second and third peak. And so I think there is going to be something that at least makes me, if you see it, I will feel comfortable about what the result is. I wonder.
You can also see both in different events. If you see one face on and one edge on, you might see one in the bluer component and one in the red component.
Yeah, so one detection is not enough for sure.
And I do think, pushing on are there any times where there might actually be speckled features? Just on the theoretical side.
So we look, I think, and the thing we haven't done enough of is looking, seeing can you do something. For lines, there isn't, we couldn't find anything. But for, basic colors, maybe there is something that really we think there's no way around. And certainly that's where we're going right now. But you are looking, I don't think there's going to be a ultra strong line that's going to gonna make you wake up. Yeah. Oh yeah. So Oleg did this. Oleg Korobkin did this, and that is a game. But decay lines. So I wasn't talking about decay. Decay lines. That's the other way. Then we want a better gamma ray telescope than we have. Oleg Krogan did this calculation of what do the decay lines look, and there you usually have a few dominant, although even there it's harder than, nice thing with nickel 56 or titanium 44, it's one dominant element. They have a few lines that are, on the order of 10 lines that you can look at, and in any kind of spectral bin, there's only a couple. So titanium 44 and NuSTAR, we have two lines. There's a lot more when you're talking about a mix of lanthanides all decaying. But there is some strong lines. At least he calculated spectra where he had strong lines from decay lines. But they are not that bright. You know, we don't even have that many supernova that we see. Well, but if, I mean, well, it's, I mean, it's still worth calculating, but the issue is, you know, I'm not, you know, for supernova, we'd learn a whole bunch about the equation today if we could just detect a neutrino signal that had lots of neutrinos. And, you know, if you go look at Sanjay Reddy's thesis, he says, any day now, we're going to get a really strong neutrino signal. Well, he might die before that any day happens. And so that, you know, I only really care about things that I think I'll observe in my lifetime. So how far away is the furthest pulsar?
Gamma ray, 15 kilometers.
And you're talking hundreds of megaparsecs.
Let's say, like.
No, but remember, this would be highly magnetized. You gain.
So yeah, I mean, okay, if it's a magnetar spinning really rapidly, you can get something. But let's imagine now it's just the pulsar phase of something. You know, we. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's even true for Counselor Grace, right? I mean, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it is a proposed model for GRB, so you know, it has that in it. So. For a brief time, right? It's just at the last stages of the merger. Yeah.
It's valid here, it should be valid here.
Your
So in my optimistic self, because this is where I am working, is, you know, I think if we work hard enough on getting the disk ejecta and trying to see the differences, knowing the different, you know, the neutron star neutrinos can change the YE. I bet if we do this enough work, and it might not happen, you know, in the next 10 years, but it will happen, and we do the light curve calculations and the opacities as well as we can, I think we will learn lots of information from the EM. But at this point, I don't think we can. I think we just get the positions. And
so I think we also gain by being able to do focus simulations once Daigo tells us what to actually.
Yeah.
What the event is.
If they tell us the event, yeah, then we can really comb in on it.
If I need a wide parameter space and I can give you generate 10 trends, if you tell me, oh, it's a 1.2% 1.4 yeah. plus or minus 0.1.
Yeah, then we can do it.
I can only do a lot more.
But I think for that we have a we still have a lot more work to do, and then so the pinpointing is how makes it so it's less work because it just reduces the parameter space. But it's at the level that we're going to have to reduce the parameter space to do this well enough that we can do it, because I think it's pushing beyond what we can currently do with
all parameters
with our current calculations. The nice thing with being a computational theorist is. You just wait a little bit of time and the computers get that much faster, and so what is hard today you can go do is trivial 5 years later, so if you can get your code to scale. Anything else on this? Yeah, but the other one I'm going to get yelled at more from, so I'd rather limit how much yelling I got. In one day. Oh, we have 20 minutes.
Yeah. Don't just tell us, we'll yell at you.
So, okay, since you said it, so, well, okay, I don't even have to stand up. I don't have to write anything down. What I was trying to think of, okay, since the topic of this meeting is really black hole binaries, and I was trying to think of, what astronomy are we going to do with there's lots of physics you can do, but what for astronomers, and Stan talked about this, so this is from yesterday's talk, things that would help progenitor stars is spin rates, or at some level black hole mass distributions, but things like I'm not convinced, and I'm fine to be told I'm otherwise, that we're likely to observe any black hole binaries in that pair pulsation, pair instability mass gap. So my, what astronomy are we going to do from black hole binaries? Because how well can we do spins? If we can do spins, we can constrain rotation rates of stars. And if we can constrain rotation rates of stars, it tells us something about magnetic field coupling. It tells us a lot of physics that we don't know about stars. But to do so, we need to get spins, and the problem I had with spins, and people can correct me on this, is that there's a, the problem is that there's more than one thing that can give you a signal to make it so it's hard to say what the spin rate is. So the question is, are we going to be doing much astronomy with black hole binaries, or we can get mass distributions probably, but is there more? Are we really going to? I mean, we've already had this discussion many times, but from the point of view of me being a cynic, what are we going to do? Can someone?
I guess my question is if the spins are aligned, you can actually do pretty damn well.
Yeah.
Right? You already have less than 0.15 if they're aligned. So the question is whether there are big kicks associated with black hole work.
So we know some black holes have kicks. We know.
Those are ones where the companions are polluted with supernova ejecta, so they probably weren't direct collapse.
So there is a question of how many. Yes, so you can assume that the most massive black holes perhaps didn't have kicks because they didn't have any ejecta. So you could argue that only the ones that are formed through fallback are get kicks. So if you make that assumption, that's good. And there could be evidence of that. And then you can say the spins are aligned and you can get very tight. How tight can you get the spin rates?
Yeah. So light would get hopefully on sort of those are binaries. If you have binaries that have single transcript, you're going to have modulation in these low ones. Also, if you have an interesting mass ratio, like 10 to 1, essentially the spin you're measuring at the end of the day is the spin of the primary.
Yeah, okay.
So, a slightly related question. So there are claims of very high spin observations in X-ray binaries. This is a question for the population synthesis people. Are the progenitors of the X-ray binaries where we've tried to measure spin by iron lines and continuum fitting, is this a completely different evolutionary channel in the standard classical scenario than the black hole binary system? Or is there anything interesting to do by saying, I have two different types of spin measurements that they do or don't do for you?
So we find that the spins in the X-ray binaries are essentially the original spins of black holes that they were in. And the reason for this is that you either have a low mass X-ray binary and you have very little mass activity but lots of time, or you have a high mass X-ray binary and you have also not so much mass and even less time.
Right.
So so the spins that come out to be quite large look like original spins, unless the methods used to estimate the spins
Well, I think this is the data question. Imagine LIGO comes back with all those spins. Do we conclude that all the other astrophysical spin measurements are
Or could it be
chemically homogeneous evolution for binary black holes versus something different for X-ray binaries? That's sort of the question. How related do these inferences have to be?
So there is certainly a difference in bias. So, you know, there's a difference in mass range bias of what you're seeing in the high mass X-ray binary versus the black hole binaries. But I'd bet that they're not so, you know, if you looked at population synthesis, they're not so distinct. Is that true, Tomek?
Are those stars different than the ones between them?
That's
IC-10 next to us. I mean, that, I love that object. What's the deal? Why are, you know?
Do you need spin measurements coming from raw iron to alpha?
So from alpha and the continuum.
Okay.
That is going to be so far, and there is, there's controversy about how it's happening.
There's many people with their brother.
There are many, many approaches that agree.
So, yeah, because it's accreting from, it's a low mass X-ray binary.
Yeah, there's a 0.3 solar mass, and even a 10 solar mass black hole.
And the black hole, and what's the black hole, what's the spin measurement for that black hole?
0.9, 8 or something, 1. And there's several of them, like, several of them.
Can you form X-ray binaries by chemically
or
using several?
Well,
that, you can specifically form the high spin.
Have you guys looked at that specifically? Were you
at the same time? Yeah, I was at the same time. So, yeah, any X-ray binary you would be producing, since this only produces very massive black holes, will be, I would expect it to be a nuclear luminous source. I don't know what's...
But not, what is the system, sterile AO something or other?
Well, there are many, all black holes, like there are all including the famous AOs, 20-00, but there are 10 other ones that are very large, so I can work with all of that very large scale. There are 5 to 10 solar mass black holes in the world.
And unassailably large spin, so you're very confident in spin.
Well, no. These are, well, relative.
Well, I see that one.
No, I don't know for that.
dependent with the environments, we can play with it. The boundaries, but it's going to be hard to do this from here.
So she's asking about, what kind of electromagnetic signal do you see from black hole binaries? We had this morning, which I think one, so that was another question I had was, but you kind of answered a lot of this. Is one is you have to store some mass somewhere. And so for these high mass ratios, you can get in the, which L F4. But so that's, and then the other thing you were looking. Yeah, the equivalent of the Trojans. But then the other way is, you somehow anchor some magnetic fields. And so how much mass do you have to anchor a reasonable magnetic field? And reasonable for me is high enough that when they interact, they produce a signal you can observe. It's like... Yeah, okay. So it's... Right, B divided by 10 to the 4, so you need a, what units are you talking about? 10 to the 4? Okay. B over 10 to the 4. So a 10 to the 4 Gauss field.
It's really hard to get.
Hard to get it, interestingly.
optimizing the system, so I'm sure you're cool. I don't know whether this is working right.
I don't think that it's in any way what the observers will say no good anytime soon. But the other thing is a tertiary system, it requires a number of points, it requires a lot of coincidences. But if you have a third star that has oscillatory frequencies that match the frequency that's being emitted in gravitational waves, you can get resonant absorption of the star. And a bunch of people have looked at this actually. So there's some papers. The problem is that the astro seismology is very hard to do. You need a very close tertiary, template 5 RG.
But
you
can make it right.
You can make it right. I think it's not. I think it's basically the things don't. It doesn't work out for light and binary.
To see this outside of our galaxy,
So there's no talk on Monday morning to give people time to work. There'll be a discussion of testing GR on Monday afternoon.
There's the Blackboard.
And the Blackboard talk at lunchtime. So director's Blackboard talk that Daniel's giving
at 12.
And then a 2 o'clock session, but nothing in the morning. And then Tuesday, we discuss between the organizers if people are happy with this, just to give people a bit more chance to actually get some work done. Meeting for the talks in the morning. Maybe having the discussion go a bit longer till 12:30, but then actually not meeting in the afternoon, early family volunteer to not leave this session. Just to give people a bit more chance to actually get something done rather than 2 hours and then talk to them 2 hours and then talk to them.
So people are going to wine tasting on Sunday, is that
the idea? Okay.